Okay, Erev Tov to everyone. We're back doing our study of the centurions. Tonight looking at the 15th century, sponsored as always by Becky and Avi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. So some of the centurions are difficult to identify because several people play leading roles in the events of those centuries, and in other centuries the centurion really stands out because no one else lived through, experienced, epitomized, shaped, and led the Jews of his generation. For the 15th century, the choice is really obvious. There's one person who lived a life of tragic grandeur, who was battered by the harsh currents of the time, of his time, and who persevered, and who lives on in any number of ways until today. And I'm referring to Don Yitzhak Abravanel. Just a brief word on his name. So Don is a Spanish honorific that's used for royalty or aristocracy. Women are Doña. Mafia is the same thing, like Don Corleone. It's the same basic idea. So he was born Yitzhak Ben Yehuda in Seville with a family name, technically either Abravanel or Abrabanel. For some reason, though, the common usage has always been Abarbanel. That's the name of the wine company, I suppose, thinking it's after him or after it was a Spanish family. The street name in Rehovia is really Rehov Abravanel also, but yet it's similarly mispronounced. But I'll try to say Abravanel through the night, having lived on that street for a year. So Don Yitzhak was born in 1437 in Lisbon, Portugal, and he was raised in wealth and style, which you don't often have in a family that itself suffered from the anti-Jewish excesses of the time. Now, the great calamity of the 15th century was the expulsion from Spain in 1492 as a dramatic and cataclysmic end to 7 centuries of Jewish life in Spain, Jewish life that was often very advanced and flourishing. But the expulsion did not suddenly appear out of the blue in 1492. It had its roots a century earlier in the great pogroms of 1391 that we touched on last time. Spanish life declined. It wasn't a sudden upheaval. In 1391, inspired by a fanatical priest named Ferrand Martinez, rabid Catholic hordes first attacked the Jews of Seville. It was June 6, 1391. 4,000 Jews were slaughtered, more than half the Jewish population, and most of the others were forcibly converted. Among the converts was Reb Shmuel Abravanel, who was Don Yitzhak's grandfather, who was given the name Juan Sanchez of Seville. Now the riots then spread from Seville throughout Spain, even into Provence in southern France. Thousands of Jews fled, including the great Rivash of Yitzhak Ben Sheshes, who was the Gadol Ador, who moved to Algiers, where he became the Rav, and he died in 1407. Now, many of these converts took to Christianity. One even became an archbishop, Jew, a persecutor of Jews. Others enacted harsh anti-Jewish legislation. In other words, to curry favor with their new co-religionists, they embarked on a crusade against their own people. And all this legislation was designed to force Jews to convert to Christianity, or in some cases, because of economic deprivation, to induce Jews to convert to Christianity. And Jews did. Again, we discussed this a few years ago. It's not something that we like to talk about openly. But most Jews, for the first time in history in a particular country, did convert to Christianity. Probably upwards of 500,000 Jews during the course of that century converted to Christianity, half a million being much larger than half of the Jewish population. If that wasn't enough, the pressure of the legislation or the physical attacks weren't enough, the Jews were again compelled to participate in a disputation. This one at Tortosa that lasted about a year and a half. They didn't meet every day, obviously. But beginning in 1413, in February, ending in November 1414, I think 69, 70 sessions in all, Jews were forced to debate Christians. Some great Jews were involved, Rebbe Albo for one, but which the Jewish side effectively lost. They lost for a good reason. Having learned the lessons of the disputation at Barcelona with the Ramban, the Christians did not allow the Jews to speak freely. They raised questions and not allowed the Jews to answer. It was essentially sport. Jews, though, were forced to sit and listen to unrefuted attacks on the veracity of the Torah, and mass conversions resulted, even conversions on the spot in the palace where this was taking place. More Jews apparently converted and fled, with many Jews pretending to convert, secretly remaining practicing Jews, conversos, but earning the enmity and rage of the church, and especially of local lay Catholics. We'll get back to that later, but they were always suspected by the locals of converting insincerely for economic reasons. They, being nominal converts, were not subject to the anti-Jewish legislation, so they became prosperous. And the more they became prosperous, the more they antagonized the locals. But such was life in Spain in the 15th century. Now, if Shmuel of Ravenel, who was an advisor to the King of Castile, he, after the riots of 1391, the late 1390s, after his forcible conversion, he left the country, moved to Portugal, where he resumed a practicing Jewish life. His son Yehuda, and later his grandson Don Yitzchok, would enter the family business as well, which was government service in finance. All their lives, though, would be molded by the intense fanatical hatred of Jews by the 15th century Catholic establishment. So Yitzchok Abravanel was born in Lisbon, in Portugal. As a young man in Lisbon, he was a student of Rabbi Yosef Chayun. He's known to us, wrote a parish on Meseches Avos called Milei D'Avos. You know, the Rebbeim too weren't local, but under whose influence he came, Rabbi Yitzchok Abohav II, not to be confused with the first, and Rabbi Yosef Ibn Shem Tov. And in the tradition of Spanish Jewry, he received a broad secular education as well. Now keep in mind the era in which we're discussing. The Renaissance had dawned, and Don Yitzchok became acquainted with all the cultural and intellectual currents of the day. He was very worldly. In addition to being a Talmid Chacham, his father Yehuda was the financial advisor, treasurer to King Alfonso V, if you're keeping score at home, the fifth of Portugal. At that time, when Yitzchok Abravanel came of age, he went into private business as well as advising the Portuguese king on affairs of state, and he became extremely wealthy. Not many people that we've discussed who were wealthy. He was extremely wealthy. At the same time, he began writing Sfarim, including a treatise on Ashgacha. He gave shiurim as well to the Jewish community in Lisbon, including very famously on Sefer Devarim in Chumash, which he transcribed as well. How wealthy was Don Yitzchok Abravanel, a young man in Portugal, young man on the make? He personally paid for the ransoming of Jewish hostages in Morocco, after King Alfonso had won a war, the Jews were being sold as slaves. He ransomed them all. Another time, he personally put together a loan of 12 million reals to King Alfonso. Now, I don't know how much a real was worth back then, but 12 million sounds like a lot. He raised the money from Christians and Jews, but 10% of it, meaning 1.2 million reals, was his own money that he put in. Upon his father's death in 1471, Don Yitzchok, at age 34, succeeded him as the treasurer for Alfonso V of Portugal, and in that capacity he made money for the king, for himself, and he was able to protect the Jewish community from harm. This is a very idyllic and pleasurable existence. It all came to a crashing end, as these things often seem to, when his boss and patron, Alfonso V, died. As happened before, you might recall a similar story with Rav Shmuel HaNagid and then his son, Rav Yehosef HaNagid, although Rav Shmuel HaNagid weathered the storm. Whenever there's a change in government, in an autocracy, so the old established rulers, the bureaucracy, the ministers, are always suspect, especially if there is a feud, a dispute over the throne. So here, Alfonso's the fifth son and successor, Juan II, resented Don Yitzhak Abravanel and accused him of being part of a conspiracy to deny him the throne, to overthrow him in cahoots with the Duke of Braganza, who was summarily executed. What happened? It's a very interesting story. Juan II kept him in his employ, and in 1483, which is just a short time after his father had died, he tells Don Yitzhak he wants to send him on a mission to a small town in Portugal. On the way there, he stops in an inn, and one of the locals tells him, "You're being sent to your death. They've been told that when you arrive there, they should execute you." So he quickly turned around, left, and he fled Portugal altogether, fled to Spain, to Castile, where he took up residence in Toledo, and was able to take much of his wealth with him. Think of the cleverness of the plan. Not that I'm trying to give you easy ways to murder people. But had he gone to that town where he was not as well known, and he was just killed by an unknown, so people say, well, that's the nature of the times in which they live. You know, these things happen. And there's nothing to do. It would not be traced to Juan II, or just be a random homicide. But he was stopped by a stranger who apparently had figured out what was happening, and so he saved his life. Now, out of work, but independently wealthy, Don Yitzhak returned full-time to his first love, which was Torah. And then there he began, in Toledo, his magnificent commentary on Tanakh. He first wrote a parish on Sefer Yoshua. It took him all of 14 days in the fall of 1483. This we know because he himself recorded his biographical data in the Hakdamah. Let me just read. You get a flavor of how he writes and what he has to say about his times. Ani Agever, which of course is the beginning of the third parak of Echa. Ani Agever Anis, he says, Ani Agever Yitzchak ben Ishchai Rav Palim B'Yisrael Gadol Shmo Adon Yehuda, his father, Ben Shmuel, Ben Yehuda, Ben Yosef, Ben Yehuda, Mibnei Abravanel, Kulam Anashim Rashi B'nei Yisrael, Mishoresh Yishai, Beis Halachmi, Mimishpachas Beis David, Nigid Umitzavel Umi, Zecher Tzadok Livracha. Notice here he claims descent from Malchus Beis David and lists his entire lineage as well. Shalav ha'yisi b'veisi, bayis v'ho nachlas ovos, bayis malei birkas Hashem, bilizbona ha'mehulolo ir v'ein b'malchus Portugal. He was living in tranquility, in wealth, the heritage of his fathers, in Lisbon, the great city in Portugal. Shom tziva Hashem es habrocha ba'asumei ha'oshev ha'kavod lifanai v'tanugos b'nei Adam. He lived in great wealth and luxury and honor. Banisi li batim alios mevulachos. He had homes, he had upper stories. Beisi beis vadel chachamim. He turned his house into yeshiva as well. Kishama yashu kisos lemishpat. And Lee writes, he always weaves psukim from Tanakh into what he has to say. And he says he had svarim, a library, he had great wealth, he had hon otok zdoka yad vashem toa gadula kidibora mashem elam. and he had run on the Hechal HaMelech Don Alfonso, Melech Gibor U'Mashol Mimshal Rav V'Yerd Mayim Adyom V'Chol Asher Yaseh Yatzliach, is a very successful king who was his employer, Melech Boteach Pashem, a believer in God, Yorei V'Sor Meira Doresh Tov Lamo Ochamei Tzadas Chein V'Sechel Tov. And all this, of course, ends by Hi Hayom Yom Tzora V'Tochecha V'Na'atzo L'Chol Amol Yisrael Na'achlaso Ben Yaakov B'Chirov. On that day Hayachoshech Nafal L'Mishgov. Then he died Yamim Achadim, and then his life changed. Evel Gadol Ayehudim Vayere B'Vas Yudo Ta'aniyo V'Aniyo. And he was in mourning. Vayimloch b'no tachtov don Yuan melech hadash asher lo yada hafach libo l'sno sarav l'snakel bavadov. And he tells the whole story of how he was threatened and how he had to flee. And now he writes his parish on Yeshua. It was quickly followed by commentaries on Shoftim, on Shmuel, and on most of Sefer Melachim. And Don Yitzhak here developed a style that he would use throughout all his commentaries. His style is, he would spell out at the beginning of the parak, at a brief introduction to the parak, and then he'd spell all the questions that he had on the parak. Spell out the questions, and then answer them in order, but in essay form, and always with a suffix after a long paragraph, v'imzeh hutra ha'shela rishona. With this, the first question resolved, or the several questions. So for example, he begins his commentary on Yeshua with a question. Why does the Navi begin? V'hi achrei mos Moshe. And it came to pass after Moshe died. We know that already. If you read the Torah, you know Moshe died, so why would we be doing things that we know already? So he says, firstly, because it connects it to the Torah. You shouldn't think it's distinct. There's no flow. It's to supplement and to connect it with what the divine Torah had already completed. And to show us that it was right after Moshe died that God spoke directly to Yeshua, what had not happened as long as Moshe was alive. And to teach us that one malchus does not encroach on another, even a hair's breadth, something that Don Yitzhak knew very well from his own experience. It's a new world when there's a new king. Three insights in a simple question. Why does the Navi begin with those words? And you see, in fact, that Don Yitzhak occasionally digressed from or shed light on the stories of the monarchies and governments of Israel by commenting on current Jewish history through which he was living, or the monarchies of Europe of his day and his interactions, or the state of the Jewish people. So he saw Jewish life in every aspect, especially the national hardships and degradations that Jews were suffering from, all as fulfillments of the words of the Nevi'im. So it was more than just ancient histories, exactly as it was intended to be. So he read the Navi, and he saw exactly the lives of his people in his time as emerging from the words of those Nevi'im. He also had the great advantage of learning from and citing and occasionally disagreeing with all the Mefarshim who preceded him, that he lists copiously from Rashi, Rabban, even through his older contemporary, Rabbi Yitzhak Arama, the Baal HaKedat Yitzhak, who wrote Chumash and the Megillos. So the Abravanel's commentary is really a summary, but it's much more than that, because much of it is original and much is insightful as well. You can feel free to disagree with some of the interpretations. He also incorporated the Zohar in his work on occasion. He also, as strange as it sounds, cites Christian Bible commentators, Jerome and others, usually to point out their errors, if there's a pasuk that the Christians use to Christianize the Tanakh, So he would say, explain why they're wrong, but occasionally he accepted a particular pshat. He liked the word that they had on a pasuk, so he would write it with the attribution as to who said it. He was also extremely verbose, and anyone who has seen his commentary, I have the Navi in front of me, it's very repetitive, and his commentaries are very long. A paragraph can run for pages, and he's not even that big on punctuation either. So it's a very long and even exhaustive work. Now sometimes he explains, I just noticed before, he writes in Sefer Melachim, writes an enormous length about the Beis HaMikdash of Shlomo HaMelech. And he explains at the end why. It's to show that whatever the Christian world has built across the globe in terms of churches, and remember, we're talking the 15th century and the Renaissance, the Catholic Church spent exorbitant sums of money taken from the poor people of the time to build cathedrals in Spain and France and Germany and Italy, literally leaving the people without bread so each pope or each king could have an edifice to himself. See, he wanted to show with his very long discussion of the Beis HaMikdash that whatever they're building now, and he writes this, it's ke'efes vato compared to the Beis HaShem. Nothing they're building now in Europe compares to the majesty of the Beis HaMikdash of Shlomo HaMelech. Now, this he did in Toledo in 1484. It took 6 months, and his hiatus did not last long. He completed his commentary on the Vim Rishon in about a half year, at which point he was impressed into the service of Queen Isabella of Aragon and King Ferdinand of Castile, who had united their kingdoms in marriage, and now they appointed Don Yitzchok as the royal treasurer, the same job that he had held in Portugal. So clearly, Don Yitzchok had a gift. Ferdinand and Isabella became extremely wealthy as a result of his advice, his investments, his management of their portfolio. He was Ish Matzliach. You know someone like that? Okay. Don Yitzchok joined with Rav Avraham Senor, who was the chief rabbi of Castile, who was the royal tax collector in chief. That's not such a good job for anyone, much less a rabbi. And he was also, I don't know how well known this is, but Rav Avraham Senor was the shadchan for Ferdinand and Isabella, because he'd been advising the government of Castile and the rivals of Aragon, and he said to Ferdinand's father, set them up and you won't have any problems anymore. In fact, that's what happened. Don Yitzchok himself was allocated geographical areas in Spain from which he personally could collect farm taxes and increase his wealth as well. Among the uses of his money, when Ferdinand began his fateful war in 1491 to remove the last Muslim presence from the Iberian Peninsula, Don Yitzchok lent an enormous sum of money, 1.5 million gold ducats, to the government to finance the war. And they were successful. The Moors were driven from Granada, and finally, after centuries, maybe for the first time in history, all Spanish territory was completely Christian. Now this had grave consequences for the Jews. Isabella had always been a fanatical Catholic, much more fervent than her husband. In 1481, she brought the Inquisition to Spain in the person of her personal confessor, the Dominican priest Tomas de Torquemada, Yemach Shmo v'Zichro. Now the Inquisition did not target Jews. It's a common misperception. It targeted sinful Christians, but it did target conversos, of whom there were more than 10,000 were executed in a decade by Torquemada, often very brutally. It was after the conquest of Granada and the existence of an all-Christian Spain that Isabella acted upon the idea to make Spain all-Christian, not only in territory, but also in population. The Muslims had already been driven out, and on March 31st, 1492, In the Alhambra Palace in Granada, Ferdinand and Isabella signed the Edict of Expulsion, which gave Jews exactly 4 months to leave or to convert. Either way, Spain would become all Catholic. Don Yitzhak Abravanel and Rav Avram Senior negotiated feverishly with the monarchs to allow the Jews to stay, offered tremendous sums of money in order to convince the king. He offered to waive most of the war debt that they owed him, plus interest. He offered to advance them money from the tax receipts he was collecting from his territory, even offered the king an outright bribe of money that he was not entitled to in any event. Isabella would not be moved. The truth is, Ferdinand was less zealous. He himself offered Don Yitzhak an opportunity to stay on and serve in the government and not convert. We could remain Jewish, but Don Yitzhak refused. According to legend, Ferdinand was ready to accept the money. When Torquemada burst into the throne room, threw a cross on the ground in front of the king and dared him to sell his soul for money, just like Judas. Judas is a loaded term for Christians, so Ferdinand retreated. Sad to say, most Jews converted, including Rav Avram Senior, who had been the chief rabbi of Castile. He and his son were baptized on June 15, 1492, with Ferdinand and Isabella in present and their sponsors. Here, Rav Avram Senior even took the name Ferdinand. So the estimations differ. Anywhere from 400,000 to 600,000 Jews converted to Catholicism in the 15th century. And a smaller number became conversos. It's an unknown number. It's very interesting. I was just reading before, the conversos have a much better reputation today than they did then. We have almost an exotic image of them, you know, gathering to daven and to remain Jews and hold on to Jewish practices. In truth, they were despised by the Jews back then. So I look today, one of the great authorities on Spanish Jewry in the 15th century is Professor Ben-Zion Netanyahu, who's the Prime Minister's father. In fact, he wrote his dissertation on Don Yitzhak Abravanel, but he wrote his magnum opus at the age of 85. It was published. He turns 101 in less than 3 weeks. He's still alive. At the age of 80, he published his major work called The Origins of the Inquisition. So there he has a theory. He posits controversially, but persuasively, that the conversos were reviled by the Jews of the time. And it's a modern myth that any significant number observed the Torah in secret. See, dismiss the notion, based on contemporaneous accounts, that these were Jews who were forced converts. Because he says, if that were so, when some of them did try to return to the Jewish community, they're very often rebuffed. They wouldn't have been rebuffed if they were forced. After all, they could have fled. So in fact, the Jews of the time spoke very harshly about them. And among the people that he quotes in his book is Don Yitzhak Abravanel, and in his commentary on Navi. It's very interestingly, this is in Yechezkel, Perek Chof, Pasuk Lamed Beis, that most trying Pasuk that speaks about if the Jews say, we'll be Kechol Agoyim, then God says, V'chema Shfucha, with an outstretched hand and with wrath pouring forth, I will rule over you. So he writes that this pasuk is discussing the Mishumadim V'ha'anusim of his day. It's talking about them. She'omdu b'yadusam, V'shamru dasam. I'm sorry, I just skipped the lines. There are some Jews who went to the lands of Yishmael, and there amdu b'yadusam shamru dasam. They continued to remain Jews and observe the Torah. Uchenegad hamishumadim v'anusim sheyotzu michlal adas. Against the mishumadim, the apostates, who we would say are those who converted willingly. V'hanusim. The hanusim are those who ostensibly were forced to convert. He doesn't distinguish. He says, Sheyotu mechlal adas, Amar uvachem ashfuchem loch aleihem. God says, I will rule over them with fury poured forth. Shachem ahim epnei she'ovu el adas. The wrath is because they violated the Torah. The Ramas bazeh she'af al pisha yishtaglu heim v'zar macharem lios kegoyim, gemurim. He says, even though they will try in coming generations, they and their descendants, to be non-Jews, hine lo yiechein, it'll never be. Ki tamid yikrir osam mishpachos aratzos yehudim. The Catholics will always call them Jews. Uveshem Yisrael yichanu balkarcham, against their will, they'll be called Jews. V'yachshuvu osam liyehudim, and they'll always be considered Jews in those nations. V'yalilu aleihem shem yisyadim b'seiser, and they'll accuse them of observing Judaism in secret. Uva'esh sarof yisrafu osam alzeh, and in the fire they will burn them for this. That's uvechem ashfucha emloch aleichem. All of which came true. This he wrote a decade later, but all of which came true. In fact, they were ferreted out. They were accused, even falsely, of observing Judaism in private. You may recall from our discussion of a few years ago that the Jesuits, that group of priests, were founded in the mid-16th century because too many priests were descendants of Jews. And so the Jesuits, the only changes in the 1950s, by the way, had a rule that you couldn't be a Jesuit unless you could prove Catholic blood for five generations. That's how in the 16th century they distinguished themselves from other priests who were either Jews or children or grandchildren of Jews. They wanted to have pure blood Catholicism. And it was only the 50s, after the Holocaust, where they realized the symbolism was terrible, that they abandoned that. He writes in Yeshayo as well, in Perek Mem Gimel, Pasuk Vav, that we see already in our day. He says, get it in 1 second. Od ra'inu shehis olu agoyim keneged hanu simayot simi adas bizmanenu. He said, they raise pretexts against the Anusim who left the faith in our day, saying they're not observing their faith properly. By the hundreds and thousands they were burned to death. This pasuk in Yeshayo is the exact same thing. He says this pasuk is speaking about our day, that those who want to escape and remain Jews, they have that opportunity. Others who don't, they'll eventually be burned. And indeed, many Jews left. Perhaps 100,000 went to Portugal before the expulsion, which 5 years later would also force Jews to convert or leave. And maybe another 200,000 traveled east, fleeing Spain for a more hospitable climate. So Don Yitzhak was in that number as well, one of the leaders of the group that migrated eastward, and he himself was a great inspiration to the Jews of the time. Think about it. He could have stayed. He could have stayed and lived in luxury as a Jew, as a government minister, but he refused to abandon his brethren. It was during this time, during the 3 weeks in 1492, that Don Yitzhak left Spain for the very last time. Now, undoubtedly, he had a prime role in financing the journey of Christopher Columbus, because Ferdinand and Isabella had long pockets and short hands. They didn't like to spend any of their money. Columbus's journey, as we know, sailed west on the morning after Tisha B'Av in 1492 at the behest, under the flag of Spain, at behest of Ferdinand and Isabella, under the flag of Spain. And that's a separate story. So no doubt he was involved in the financing before he left. But he was allowed to leave with some, but not all of his fortune. There's a beautiful symmetry to Don Yitzchak Abravanel's life. Whenever he was freed from government service, he went back to the world of Torah. He settled first in Naples, Italy, on the west coast of Italy. Soon after, he completed his long-delayed commentary on Melachim. Things he couldn't write while he was working. It happens to be true. But within a short time, King Ferrante I of Napoli retained him as his treasurer. Reputation preceded him, and Don Yitzchak was back to work. This lasted for maybe a year and a half, maybe 2 years, until 1494, when the French invaded and conquered Naples, and they sacked Don Yitzchak's home, destroying in the process his entire library of Svarim that he had brought with him from Spain. Don Yitzchak followed the royal family, now Alfonso II, to Sicily, to Messina. And after Alfonso died, Don Yitzchak settled on the island of Corfu, where he wrote his commentary on Yeshayahu that I just cited. Again, and Don Yitzchak's last 2 decades were marked by constant travel, he returned to the Naples area in 1496 when the French left. It was during this period that a most remarkable event took place. He suddenly recovered. How? No one really knows. He suddenly recovered a manuscript, a copy of his transcription of his shiurim on Sefer Devarim that he assumed was lost in Portugal when he was still a young man. It turned up, he completed it, as well as commentaries on the Haggadah, which is very popular even today. I think it was translated in English a couple of years ago, and on Meseches Avos, he did it on the island of Corfu, and then back in Naples as well. But the Parish on Dvarim became the springboard from which he would later write his commentary on the whole Torah. In the 1490s, and this has long-term implications, Don Yitzchak became preoccupied with another area, especially because of the catastrophe of the expulsion and the turmoil of the times. He wrote systematic studies of Geula, of redemption, of Bias HaMashiach, of Yemos HaMashiach, of the return of the exiles. Full-length books on each of these topics in order to hearten the people. So one of them, and these are all extant, Yeshua's Mashicho, expounds on the long-term implications of the Bris Ben Absarim. You remember it was dark, Hoshech, Nuflo, and the Medrash has that he had visions of the four Golios. He expounds on that based on Perek Lamed Beis of the Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer and part of the Sefer, the second part of the Sefer, the numerous statements of Chazal about Yemos HaMashiach and Perek Chelek, all of which he elaborates on. Another Sefer, Mashmiya Yeshua, discusses the words of the Nevi'im on the Geula. So he called from all the Nevi'im what they had to say. So both Sarim, of course, were meant to be comforting and hopeful to a nation to whom ultimate redemption looked quite distant. So another Sefer, Mayanei HaYeshua, was a commentary on Sefer Daniel that also addressed eschatological matters. Don Yitzchak also wrote a defense of the Rambam's Yud Gimel Ikarim. It was called Rosh HaManah. It was a critique of Rabbi Yosef Albo's criticisms of the Rambam. He wrote numerous sermons. He was a very, very prolific author. The only thing he seemed to lack was an editor, because all his works are very long, and his sentences and paragraphs are very long, very comprehensive. Many of these latter works were written in Venice, to which Don Yitzchak moved in 1503. Venice, as you know, was its own republic. It was a capital of publishing. It's a thriving Jewish community. It was there as well that Don Yitzchak wrote most of his commentary on the Torah in the same style as the Novi. A general introduction followed by questions on the Sedra and an essay-like answer. Thus, say if we read Parshas Vayikra this week, I think he has 20, 21, 22 questions on the Sedra. The first question, why does the Torah begin Daber al Bnei Yisrael when it comes to the Karbanos, when in fact the main focus of the Avodah was the Kohanim? So the Torah should have begun by Yikrael Moshe, by the Rosh Hashanah Lemor, Saves Aron, there's Banav Lemor, you'll command Aaron and his sons, how to bring a chatas, how to bring an olo, how to bring an oshim, etc. What do the people have to know? What does Bnei Yisrael have to do with any of this? So he writes that it was in order to show kavod to the Jewish people, that they labored to build a mishkan, they waited expectantly for the Torah to emerge from there, and he writes, quoting the Ramban, he just calls them one of the Mefarshim, that the Mishkan was the reenactment of Sinai, but on a permanent basis. The Yismichuvo, they were eager to rejoice in the building of the Mishkan and the Avodah, so God was Mechabed, the Jewish people, with this reference, Daber El Bnei Yisrael. It was in Venice that Don Yitzchak died in 1508. He was buried in Padua. Padua was about a half hour ride west of Venice. Buried near the Mahari Mintz, who lived to the age of 100, Rabbi Yehuda Mintz. But Don Yitzchak's precise grave is unknown. There's a Jewish cemetery in Padua, but it was the subject of wars and other upheavals, so it's not really known who's buried where. Well, I think they may have recovered a tombstone that has a name on it, the Bravanel, but his grave itself is unknown, although it's in the Jewish cemetery in Padua in Italy. In summary, it was quite a life. Don Yitzchak Abravanel was very rich in scholarship, it was abundant in leadership, and it really was redolent of the tragedies of the Jews of that era. Don Yitzchak had four children. He had many grandchildren, including one who was forcibly baptized in 1492, and he has descendants until today. There's no doubt those with the name of Barbanel or Barbanel, they dropped the A, so they're related to that family. And he was a master of many legacies, great legacies. Think about it from a modern perspective. He was able to live in both worlds, the secular world, the Torah world, but always remain loyal to Torah and to Klal Yisrael. He was the epitome of a leader who sacrificed his wealth, his position, his status, his comfort, his home, in order not to abandon his people. It sounds very obvious, but it's not, because others succumbed. Most others succumbed. So he, in fact, was unique in that he did not, given his prominence. So Don Yitzchak Abravanel really lived the history of the Jews of the 15th century, and he showed his generation and subsequent ones how to retain confidence and hope in the future despite the ignominies of the present, a quality that would serve us well for centuries yet to come. That's the story of Don Yitzchak Ben Yehuda Abravanel. I thank you all for coming, and next week we'll look at the centurion of the 16th century. I thank you all very much.